This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. In the time of coronavirus, we're all, it seems, amateur epidemiologists trying to find a way past the contagion that's overturned our lives. We follow the headlines. You might learn about the breakthroughs on Twitter or Facebook, but often they first appear on what are called preprint servers. In fact, Ivan Oransky, professor of medical journalism at NYU and co-founder of Retraction Watch, says that many of the purported breakthroughs around the virus are being shared in spaces that are completely unvetted.
So essentially no one has seen them. There's something that a lot of preprint servers refer to as a sort of sanity check. Like, is it so beyond the realm of what could be true? I mean, if you're putting up astrology on an astronomy preprint server, you're probably not going to get through that barrier, but it's a really low bar.
There is a torrent of data being released by preprint servers that are filling in some of the holes in our understanding, maybe not very accurately, but at least it gives us something to grab onto.
There clearly is a desperate need, and what you don't want to do is sort of withhold information from people. But what you do want to do is make sure that it is vetted at some point.
But you know that even vetting isn't going to necessarily yield perfect research. Trump going overboard on that drug, hydroxychloroquine.
Hydroxychloroquine, yeah.
That came from a peer-reviewed paper. The author of it was one of the editors-in-chief of the journal it was printed in.
Yeah, in that case, it was actually technically peer-reviewed, but would it have appeared in another journal? I think the rule of thumb about no single study actually still holds. So if it is the first study to show something, no matter how strong it looks, it's about whether or not it's been replicated, whether someone has repeated something very similar to it and found a similar result, not about whether that particular paper holds up. President Trump was, in fact, pointing to a single peer-reviewed paper. It's tragic and completely predictable that after that press conference, a couple drank their fish tank cleaner because it includes chloroquine.
Another problem with peer review that you point to is the sheer volume of papers, something like 3 million a year?
That's right. That's 3 million papers, 2 to 3 peer reviewers per paper. Scientists tell me when you're doing a peer review well and properly, it takes them on average, about half a day. So, you know, call that 4 hours. 4 hours, 2.5 reviewers, that's 10 hours per paper. 3 million papers, that's 30 million hours. And some of those papers were reviewed several times at several journals because they were rejected the first or second or eighth time. So do that math. And by the way, the number of peer review requests to researchers who are experts in coronavirus now, imagine that. Just you would probably have, I don't know, 1 an hour based on the number that we're seeing. You can't possibly do them. And so what happens? Well, that peer review ends up being done by the next person in line or the eighth person in line, somebody the editor can find, but it's not someone who can really do the expert kind of analysis.
Can you give us an example of some stuff that's gotten out there in the mainstream that has subsequently been debunked?
There was a paper in early February that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, and it was a letter to the editor, which gets a much lighter peer review treatment generally, but it was in the New England Journal of Medicine, one of the world's premier medical journals. It had their stamp of approval. They did what they could to get it out.
And what did it say?
It's said that you could actually spread the virus if you didn't have symptoms yet. And now there's some evidence that that may be true, although, again, we're still in a preliminary phase. But at the time, there wasn't clear-cut evidence for what was in it. The people who wrote it might not have even seen the patient themselves. There was a lot of confusion there. And it stood for about a week until Kai Kupferschmidt of Science Magazine, who's been reporting a lot on this these issues very well, I should add, exposed the fact that there were some problems in this paper. There was another paper that came out in a virology journal that claimed to show that there were two very distinct subtypes of the virus. One of them was really virulent, and the other one maybe wasn't quite as dangerous. I'm oversimplifying that, but you may have seen headlines about these two subtypes of virus. That paper, which, by the way, hasn't had any correction on it or anything, just for the record, was very well debunked by actually a couple of virologists. There was actually a preprint that came out on a Friday afternoon at the end of January. The punchline of that paper was that because these researchers saw a lot of common proteins in this coronavirus with other viruses, including HIV, they therefore concluded, and I think this is where they just went way off the rails, that this was clearly an engineered bioterror agent. That paper was actually withdrawn within 40 hours on a Sunday. There are papers that are coming out now no one's actually going to see in order to vet properly. You know, the example of hydroxychloroquine, if you look at the downstream effects of a single paper of only a couple dozen patients switching the entire world into actually a shortage of hydroxychloroquine, which, by the way, is a drug that people with lupus very much need. It's great that there's a clinical trial going on. It sounds like something we should be trying, but we're way ahead of the evidence, and we need to be careful.
So then, do you think that there is a role for preprints, that the flow of information is essential for collaboration among scientists themselves, and that it helps us cycle through ideas faster?
I do think there's a very positive role for preprints. Science doesn't happen only when a paper is published. If anything, the horse has left the barn and you're closing the door by publishing that paper because it takes so long to publish a paper. So preprints can absolutely help scientific information flow, but you shouldn't go to a preprint server and say, well, it's got some scientist's name on it. It must be kosher. We have to stop thinking about it in a binary way and think probably a high percentage of it's going to turn out to be wrong. But preprint servers, if they've gotten the word out sooner, let other people try and replicate the experiment.
One last thing. For health and science journalists, this is absent the gunfire and continuous mortal danger, your version of war reporting, which means you're subject to fatigue and the fog of this pandemic.
Yeah, I think that all of the things that are, if you will, problematic about war reporting, and yet ultimately incredibly necessary about war reporting, are present here. I think what you have to do is actually acknowledge the fog of war, not feel the need to react to absolutely every pronouncement, every study. That's really hard to do. Pretending there aren't bullets flying over you. How do you do the dispassionate kind of reporting that you need to do in a case like this? But there are reporters who are experienced at war reporting in the same way there are reporters who are experienced at health and science reporting that was part of how they sat down to report and do that story.
Ivan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke. Always a pleasure.
Ivan Oransky is the Vice President of Editorial at Medscape, a leading journalism and healthcare site for healthcare professionals, and Professor of Medical Journalism at NYU. So, if mostly experts use preprint servers to send their unvetted studies up the flagpole, how about the non-experts? Surely, during a global pandemic poised to kill millions if the best advice is drowned out, they're going to back off and stay in their lanes, right? I mean, in the interest of public safety?
Getting severely ill.
I agree.
Ill. That's
There's no question about it. I'm not a scientist, so I agree.
I'm not a scientist, but it does feel overdone on the panicky side of the worries about the virus.
I'm not an expert in viruses by any means, but I compared it to traditional influenza.
Now, is it a panacea? Do I know this is going to work? I'm not a doctor, as I've been telling you, but I'm interested.
BuzzFeed's Ryan Broderick recently wrote an article titled, "I'm not an epidemiologist, but the rise of the coronavirus influencers." He observed that in the wake of coronavirus, several types of viral influencers have coalesced online, ranging from YouTube grifters to Silicon Valley techies to actual doctors who've taken to Twitter with actual bad information. That last category includes Harvard epidemiologist, but not virologist, Eric Feigelding, who wasn't seeking headlines. He was just putting things out there on Twitter that he'd seen, you know, just to share, attracting a heap of followers and doing some unintended damage along the way.
His tweet sharing, I believe it was a preprint that hadn't been vetted or reviewed, is what caused a conspiracy theory that COVID-19 was somehow related to HIV. So you can trace that rumor, that hoax, directly back to a tweet of his. And when I brought that up with him, you know, he was apologetic. But him and the medical experts like him who are just trying to ring the alarm bell, they're happy as long as they're ringing that alarm bell.
You describe three different groups under the coronavirus influencer umbrella. So let's start with the malignant block. These are people who are intentionally spreading disinformation, hoaxers or grifters, as you'd put it.
That's right. You have white nationalists like Tom Kowczynski, currently trying to rebrand himself as a health and fitness podcaster. YouTubers like the pro-QAnon influencer Jordan Sather.
QAnon is basically a conspiracy that says Trump is engaged in a liberty-saving fight against the deep state.
Right. His most recent thing was trying to tell his supporters that if they mix the chemicals together that create bleach and drink it, they could protect themselves from the outbreak. And he's been really, really into how to weaponize the information online about the outbreak to help himself build a following. And then websites like InfoWars and the conservative online fringe have been really interested in selling, you know, survivalist packages. And it's a whole world of either political bad agents or scammers or grifters. And they're all seeing this as a prime opportunity to find some people to take advantage of.
The right-wing magazine The Federalist recently published the, I guess you'd call it, the thought stylings of one Doug Perednia. He's reportedly an unlicensed dermatologist, and he says we should all be having coronavirus parties like when I was a kid, we had chickenpox parties in order to achieve herd immunity. And yeah, maybe some people will die, but, you know, we'll have special facilities.
The Federalist has been one of the bigger outlets to take the we need to sacrifice ourselves for the good of Trump and the economy stance. The piece you're talking about was taken down by Twitter. It's one more story in a very long line of deeply irresponsible writing that that website's been doing about the outbreak. They love to position themselves as, you know, public health experts, but their agenda is very clear, which is we need to put the sick inside and you know, obviously protect the old people, but yeah, they might die, but we got to get back to work.
That brings us, I think, to the second category you talk about. They're not intentionally lying. They are the coronavirus influencers who have no relevant experience in the fields of which they speak.
I would categorize all of these types of influencers as sort of like men who love data and are now bored at home. It's the economists, the data scientists, the Silicon Valley investors. It's like they're taking what they would be doing on LinkedIn and now they're doing it on Twitter for hundreds of thousands of people to see. I first noticed the phenomenon with coronavirus, why you must act now, on Medium. So chances are you've seen it. It's been viewed over 37 million times and it's a good piece of writing. It turned flatten the curve into a meme. It was translated into 24 languages. It was a lightning in a bottle moment. And so I was curious about who wrote it. His name is Thomas Boyeau, and I looked him up and realized that he has no scientific background whatsoever. And when I called him and asked him how he wrote the Medium piece, he said that he had just collected a bunch of stuff that he had put on Facebook and put it into a Medium post. And I was sort of horrified. And I spent an afternoon double-checking, triple-checking, finding anybody who had anything bad to say about it. I couldn't. It seems like it's pretty solid.
He advised strict social distancing measures early, urged readers to take the virus seriously.
I have no objection with him or what he did at all. It's more that a piece of writing could be, as I put it in my piece, the defining writing of this outbreak. But it has kicked off a trend of other people doing the same thing, and they're not so good, and they're getting treated just as importantly and being brought on places like Fox News to talk about their stuff. And that's the dangerous thing that's happening now.
So give me an example of that.
The most recent one was a Medium post by Aaron Ginn titled Evidence Over Hysteria, COVID-19. Ginn is a Silicon Valley technologist. He basically wrote a piece arguing that we can just calm down and we can all go back to work and things are fine. It was taken down by Medium. He then republished it on the financial blog Zero Hedge, which is notable because they started spreading really xenophobic conspiracy theories about COVID-19 a couple months ago. And Ginn was brought on Fox News to talk about his Medium piece. And they used the Medium piece as a way to say, you know, this guy is an expert. This guy is going viral. Look how great this Medium piece is. And so while Thomas Pollo was totally right and what he did was totally correct, Aaron Ginn, I think, saw that as an opportunity to legitimize himself. And Fox News jumped on it because it backed up their political narrative, which is that we need to turn the economy on no matter who dies. There will be people who go viral with information about the outbreak. It's just natural because things are flying around the internet and people are scared and people are home. But we can stop and say, why am I listening to you? Who are you? What's your agenda?
But Feigelding has said, and I think he said to you, essentially, that he believes less than perfect information is better than no information. That, from a journalism point of view, is anathema, but maybe not from a scientific one.
I wonder if he'll change his tune in a couple weeks. As we get further into this, maybe he starts to say, okay, yeah, I maybe shouldn't tweet this out without checking first. I would hope.
He's an honest and sincere actor, well-intentioned in this arena. You haven't seen and don't anticipate seeing any change in the other two categories. They'll just do their thing until the fuel runs out.
Let's call them the Trump bubble grifters, the malicious actors, the QAnon, the white nationalists, the anti-vaxxers, these people. They are very much a glitch of the problems with our modern social media platforms. They will survive apparently anything. You know, I thought maybe with the outbreak, they would disperse or change their tune. No. So I think we can now safely say that these groups and these influencers will try to profit, whether financially or politically, off of anything. With the third sort of more nebulous category, these finance bros who are into crypto and Medium, I do think people are getting smart to it. I've seen a lot of memes saying like, wait a minute, you're an economist. Why are you talking to me about the coronavirus? And I think especially with the collision of personal safety and economic benefit, this argument of should we go back to work or not, I think that is beginning to change the way people see the data people and the finance people who are sharing outbreak statistics. It is making people a little nervous about who they're listening to because you don't know what the agenda is. And I think that is ultimately a good thing because hopefully it will open up some more space for some legitimate scientists to go viral with their take or their statistics or their charts.
Ryan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ryan Broderick is senior technology reporter for BuzzFeed.
Coming up, what the pronouncements of pundits and politicians this week tell us about the current thinking on the value of life.
This is On the Media.